Welcome to Industry Insights, a podcast for, by and about the film industry from the Berlinale's European Film Market, produced in cooperation with Goethe Institut. Today's episode was developed in collaboration with Locarno Pro, inspired by Locarno's Step In think tank, where in this past year, mental health in the film industry was a featured subject. That will also be our topic here today. My name is Johanna Koljonen. I'm a media analyst, strategic consultant, and experienced designer based in Sweden. And as you know, I'm sharing hosting duties on this podcast with the excellent Nadia Denton, whom you heard in the previous episode. I do feel like I lucked out getting to do this one specifically, though, because the topic of what it would take to make the film industry a healthy work environment has lately been much on my mind. Whether reading about tragic workplace accidents on the news, listening to friends working on film crews being worried that they're too exhausted at the end of a workday to drive their cars home safely, or receiving emails in the middle of the night from production companies I'm consulting with on sustainable strategy, I'm starting to worry that we have a real problem. When we as an industry are struggling, we will work ourselves to the bone to get our projects made. And when we're experiencing a boom of demand and production, like we are right now, then we will never stop working at all. We tend to view sacrifice and suffering as necessary. Indeed, we often idealize suffering as somehow reflecting positively on our artistic credibility. But is that even really how creativity works? And what would it take to change our practices? Today we will meet two guests, Diego Hangartner and Laurence Lascaris, to discuss perspectives on these issues from outside and within the industry. And we'll start with Diego, who is a clinical pharmacologist, a certified coach, and an expert on the balance of the creative mind. Diego Hangartner, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I'm very happy to be speaking to you today, and I think I'm going to have to start with the terrifying numbers. So the UK Film and TV Charity released a study in February 2020, which was presented in Berlin, and we think that may have been the first time when mental health was explicitly a topic at an industry forum of this caliber. That report was based on over 9,000 respondents, and in it we learned that over half of British film industry professionals have experienced suicidal ideation. One in 10 have attempted to take their life. Film professionals are twice as likely as the average citizen to experience anxiety, and bullying, sexual harassment, social isolation, impossible work hours are significantly shaping this industry. When you look at this data from your professional perspective, what do you see?
Well, I see many things. One thing is obviously a situation that is specific to the film industry. However, the recent pandemic has shown us that this is not just something that we're experiencing in the film industry, but it's actually something that has come much more at the forefront of our conscious experience, which has to do with our mental health. And so for me, over the last 40 years, I've been really looking at not necessarily the negative aspects of mental health, but we have a systemic problem that we have been focusing most of our endeavors, particularly as this clinical pharmacologist, as you mentioned, about the negative qualities of the mind. And so obviously that is something that none of us wants to experience, but unfortunately we have very little understanding of what actually causes mental well-being. And so yes, it has also shocked me, the numbers that particularly the film industry, which is an industry which is obviously high-paced, very creative, and also very insecure, because you have a job today and maybe you don't have it after the film is over. And so it doesn't come as a surprise that the film industry is particularly prone to mental unwell-being. So my expertise is really in view of what is mental unwell-being, how to create mental well-being, mental flourishing. And in that sense, I do think that there are two factors that are playing in the film industry particularly. One is a systemic issue, that you have a high-paced environment where you need to basically promote yourself and get the jobs, and then the jobs are over, and then you get a new assignment, hopefully. On the other side, I also think that there is very little time for what are the factors that cultivate mental well-being, personal well-being? Because from my understanding, mental well-being is actually a skill. It's not something that just happens.
I'm going to ask you many questions about that, but I also have to say I just had an insight as you were speaking about Please. This systemic nature of the gig, this gig economy that we're all working in, that it's also about so much of the hiring is about who have you worked with before, because in these incredibly high pressure, especially in the high pressure production situations, you have to be able to trust everybody to not break, essentially, which creates a really strong economic incentive to never show if you are struggling and never show if you are feeling weak, even though perhaps everybody is. But there is this fear that I am doing worse than everybody else is, and if I show that, right. I might not be able to work again. So that already is a big structural challenge. Before we go to these aspects of what is well-being in this context, I guess I would like you to just say something about how bad is this? Are these numbers exceptionally bad? I mean, I did see that, I mean, if we see in the numbers that we are much more likely to experience mental health struggles or for instance suffer from anxiety than sort of an average citizen, it's still very difficult to measure it, because I don't know what it's like to work in any other industry necessarily. Is this normal? It's normal to us. It's common in our environment, but is it common in the world?
Well, that you just mentioned two things. One is, of course, when you're in the system, you think it's normal. And then you just take it as, well, okay, this is just how it is. But if you really look and take a step outside of it, it is higher by, depending on also self-harming or suicidal or anxiety, than the usual normal jobs. And let's just have a quick look at what are the factors that are actually conducive to well-being. And one has to do with the environment. That's a very important factor. Now, obviously, the film industry, like you were saying, is a gig economy where you really need to basically promote yourself as the best possible candidate for whatever is a cameraman, lightning or sound or even obviously actors is just the smallest part of the whole. So that in itself is already a very difficult situation. And then also the financial threats that you get. It's basically also a physical situation that you have, and then on top of it you have the social. It's a community that works long hours, that works into the night. You have to be basically ready for the next day. So there is all these different factors that are only, I've just mentioned now three factors of what is considered to be six factors. One has to do with the mental, another one with emotional, and the third one with the spiritual dimension. So these three are even more effervescent and more sort of subtle. But just looking at the real core factors like environment, physical and social context, it is obvious that this is a much more, I would say, threatened environment. And what does it do to you when you're in this constant state of threat?
What does it do to you? So, and also you may want to explain to us who are not expert, can we even talk about the mind and body separately? I'm uncertain. Things are happening in our body and that is affecting our mental state, right?
Correct. But also our mental state has an effect on our body.
Yes.
We cannot just say that it's, and this in the science, we speak about a bottom up. Basically, you have a neurological system that creates a mental experience. However, and that's the big difference, is that we know now that also a mental state has an effect on your physical. So it's not just one dimension causing, let's say, the mental, the physical causing the mental, but it's also that the mental has an effect on the physical. And we can see that with many different factors that, for example, loneliness. What does loneliness do to you? What does stress do to you? It's a physical experience, but it's also a mental experience. And so if you can regulate one of those dimensions, be that the physical, by going in nature or meeting with people, it also has a mental dimension. However, if you practice meditation and you cultivate, for example, a routine of mental hygiene, that also has an effect on the body. So it's actually both directions. Our behaviors are an expression of what? Of our mental state.
Yes.
And also our emotional state, our thinking and the feeling. However, feeling and thinking also has an effect on our actions. So it's actually bidirectional.
I'm trying to translate this to something very practical, and I'm thinking, if I sleep slightly too little over long periods of time, then I will, then that one night when I get way too little sleep, it will affect me much more. If I have slept well, then I have a higher tolerance for that one night of crisis the following day. Yeah,
exactly.
But also, yes, if I'm very stressed, then I might not be able to sleep because my mind is racing in the evening and all of those things are happening. Then I'm probably not doing, what did you call it, mental hygiene? That sounds very important. I don't know what it is, but we should talk about that as well.
Right.
Yes.
So what, and I was just going in that direction, what is actually happening in the, let's just take the brain, and I'm not saying that the brain is the only organ that basically feels, because we have also the heart and we also have the gut. But in the brain, it's clear now that stress, for example, what it does, it actually unhinges, it blocks the clear thinking, which is the prefrontal cortex. And so the prefrontal cortex is where we also have a lot of creativity. So actually you're having a double whammy. You're pushing yourself, you're stressed, and then therefore you can't think properly. And what happens is that the prefrontal cortex, or the clear thinking part of the brain, gets offline because we're under threat. So it can be a social threat. It can be a physical threat. Like you said, not enough sleep. If we sleep regularly and we have a routine, a physical activity where we really regulate ourselves time and again, then it's okay. However, if you are not doing that hygiene, be it physical as well as mental hygiene, then you, of course, you are depleting the resources. And what happens? You get actually you become less able to access your clear thinking, which is exactly what you were hoping for. And therefore, you get into a vicious circle.
I see. Mm-hmm. So one way this could express, for instance, is that I'm thinking how this connects to the structural things in the industry. But if we say that something serious but solvable goes wrong in my project or in my shoot or something like that, because it's connected in my mind, I know if we are not able to solve this problem today, it might reflect poorly on my ability to employ myself in years to come, for instance. If I mess this up, I might become branded as the person who had this disaster happen on their watch, essentially. And that means that it puts a lot of additional pressure on the specific situation. And ironically, then, if I understand you correctly, that will make my logical thinking abilities less clear or less available. So I will actually become less good at solving the problem. So which I would have maybe normally been able to solve. So actually I might create, the fear might become a self-fulfilling prophecy as well.
Exactly.
And in addition to that, I suppose, if as you're saying, the creativity also is lowered, then I can only rely on my past experience and on other similar solutions I've seen before, instead of perhaps thinking of something new that I could if I was calm and rested and not terrified.
Correct. You revert to your habitual patterns that have worked in the past, but because the new situation is not solvable necessarily with your old behavior, so it gets even worse, because then you build up even more fear and more stress, and it becomes, like you said, a full self-fulfilling prophecy. But also it actually, one language that I like to use is self-sabotage. You're actually self-sabotaging yourself by moving into that. And fear, obviously, is one of the biggest drivers, and it is very powerful. It's said that it's between 3 to 5 times more powerful than a positive thought. And so how can we think ourselves out of a fearful situation? And that's when rational thinking just goes offline.
And then you do also what everybody else does in a way, which is very inconvenient, again, in a work situation where everybody is suffering or laboring under the same kinds of fears in different ways. So I suppose in any practical situation, we'll all also just make each other more stressed.
Exactly. And we are social animals.
Yes.
So we are always picking up on what the other person's basically energy or joys are less contagious, but they are also contagious.
So I have a concern here, which is that in our cultures generally, we tend to consider mental health to be an individual issue. And even in countries where, for instance, we have very good public healthcare systems, when those were constructed, historically, mental health wasn't on the agenda in the same way as physical health. So even in a lot of those countries, it has sort of remained mental well-being and the mental health, which is, as we now discussed, directly connected to physical health and also to productivity. It still sort of remained in the sphere of the personal or the individual responsibility. And a lot of these problems don't sound to me like they're solvable on the individual level. At the same time, it's also important that there are things that we can do individually. And I don't know, how do we start to think about this? I guess if I'm in an impossible situation, I have to begin with what can I do? But the solutions on the structural level need to be outside of me. So I don't know, maybe we start with what can I do? What are some things where I can actually affect my situation?
Exactly. And there's, in my mind, there is a big problem with what we call stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. In the past, we were stigmatizing against physical handicaps, until we realize that's not necessarily a handicap for life or for flourishing or for thriving. And the problem is with mental, let's call it well-being. Unfortunately, we're using not dysfunctionality, but functionality. It is also stigmatized. We're stigmatized against it. Now, this is why I use mental fitness, because mental fitness is exactly that capacity to recover and respond with a different quality, which is not necessarily fear-based, but is more stable. So that's one of the places that we really can make a difference. Once we understand our own processes of where do I get fear? Now, of course, if you have a good, safe job environment, that might be giving you a little bit more security, a sense of, okay, I can go back to work, I don't have this physical threat that could happen. Now, that's obviously in the film industry is very much different. So that's why it does not surprise me that in this environment there is a higher degree of threat and therefore self-harming. But I do think, and the self-harming obviously is just a response to basically you don't know how to get out of it. Yeah. And so for me, it's very clear that we need to develop mental fitness in order to become aware what are the environments as well as the relationships doing to me.
Yes. And I should probably say here that self-harming, it doesn't have to be, cutting yourself. It could be destructive drinking. It could be disruptive your food. There are many kinds of, and of course, yes, all the addictions. Quite a lot of ways of, that you can sabotage for yourself as a kind of emotional release almost, yeah.
And one of the issues is that we also think often that actually relieving the symptom, a short-term intervention like drinking or then becoming repetitive about it, releases short-term issues. It does, absolutely. The problem is the consequences are mid to long term. You isolate yourself, you actually bring yourself out of one of the networks that help you support, which is the social network, or you start behaving in ways that are erratic, and therefore people start stymieing you or even avoiding you.
Or I just, I drink to be able to sleep, and then there is a brain chemistry cost even the next day or 2 days later, which may, even if it's just you got 4 hours in the day when you were not particularly smart because of some brain chemistry reason, even that is a big cost in a high stress environment, even if you don't develop a drinking problem over time.
Right.
So yes, this is very difficult. And I see what you're saying. So I guess then, okay, let's say if some of us who are listening now are thinking, I may have some of these behaviors already, clearly I'm at risk. How do I increase my mental fitness?
Obviously, it's not something that you can learn from one day to the other. And particularly, and this is where we often fail, once we think we understand it, we think we have it under control. But understanding is not enough. I know, for example, how to bake a cake. I know it needs some eggs, it needs some flour, it needs some water and some heat. And there we go and then basically just mix it all together. It's not going to be a cake because we don't know the procedure. And then once we have maybe mixed the dough properly and we put it in the oven, and we get impatient because this bloody cake is not coming, so we double the heat in order to half the time. It doesn't work like that. And so so we really need to be appropriate. And I'm saying that as a precursor to what I'm going to be saying now, which is we need first and foremost to develop a routine that is basically holding back on our habitual patterns. And that's basically making breaks, stopping, and really stopping, as opposed to once we have a stop, we complement it with TV or with the WhatsApp. Or
a break in the workday, and we're using that to answer email. That's not a break.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I really mean a break. And it's clear now that we know that there are certain behaviors that are conducive. And this is why I mentioned at the beginning, it's a skill. Mental well-being is not something that just happens. It's a skill that we can learn, like we can learn to write. But we need to know how to do it and what is the sequence. And the first step that we need to become aware of is, what are the self-sabotaging processes that I'm doing all the time? What is it that I'm continuously doing that actually appears to feel good, but actually in the long term undermines me? And then once we have this self-sabotaging process, like this voice, I'm not good enough, the inner critic. And so I work exactly with this type of processes, first and foremost, so that we identify our own inner critic sabotage processes and how do they appear.
And we're able to hack it a little bit, as you were saying before, about those physical things. I mean, so the exercise really does make a difference, and taking real breaks really does make a difference. Even, I suppose, it would be good if we had like a lot of real breaks and weekends off and things like that. But even a minute, I suppose, is better than nothing.
Absolutely.
And making sure that we do get sleep, we can build up some resilience. Because
and
I think to some people it will feel overwhelming, like, oh, I don't have time or space to do exploration and change. So then you need to find some resources to be able to at least take that 1 minute break.
Absolutely. And there are graphs, for example, for people, maybe you want to look it up. It's the Healthy Mind Platter. What are the mental qualities that we need to cultivate in order to have a healthy mind? And one is physical exercises, then time where we're focused, but not necessarily on a film from external, but internal. Hmm. Then also time where we connect with others. And when did we play really completely innocent for the last time? That is also creating new circuitry. Playing not at the kind of like competitively, but really just playing. And then also having downtime where we are not doing anything. And I don't mean compensated with WhatsApp, as I said before, but also just being and enjoying the beauty of a tree. We just have fall here and the trees are just exquisite at the moment. Yes.
Maybe that's part of the answer. Is how are we not, like, how do we even function? And I guess part of the answer to how do we even function is that a lot of us who are in different ways in creative work, so we do end up being focused on our own creative processes. That's part of the things that we often get to do. And there are elements of at least playfulness, if not necessarily free play, sometimes built into part of the labor as well. So perhaps that's also something to think about, that those parts of our work are just as important as the sort of...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and then
the others.
And then just to finish the Healthy Mind Platter, food. What kind of nutrition do we eat? Because it's clearly now that the microbiome, the gut flora, the bacteria, they play an important role in our mental well-being. And why is that? Because the absorption of the nutrients And depending on what kind of nutrients we get, it has an effect on that balance. And then, of course, the sleep time.
That's very interesting, because I think that as work environments, there are actually we're often in catered environments where there is on a sort of company level or a production level, we can affect what people eat. So that's actually a practical thing that I think is a surprising takeaway from this conversation, that we can affect. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about this thing about overwork. It's such a clear parameter. And in this industry, there are situations, you're maybe on your seventh draft of your script, or maybe you're in production with a film. Sometimes you're gonna, maybe you know that they're almost inevitably, sometimes you will maybe work 60 or 80 hour weeks for a month or even longer. If I know that I'm heading into a period like that, what should I be doing before and what should I be doing after?
I agree that 60 to 80 hours work weeks is just not sustainable. I like to take an analogy of the sport people, because in sports we have really clearly identified what is necessary for high-performing sports people. And we only see them in Olympics or at the peak of their physical performance, but they take breaks, and they take enforced breaks, and they have to take absolute breaks. They should. So that's in the lead up, even during the performance, it is necessary. Now, of course, in an environment where you're performing highly, working so long hours, what do? You take coffee, you smoke cigarettes, and they're all basically not conducive to good sleep. So you're or resting. So in the lead up, one way to do that is basically train breaks. Train breaks and keep training breaks, and maybe not be dependent too much on those substances that actually activate you. And then, of course, after the whole period, take breaks. High performing athletes, they all know how to take breaks. And that's, unfortunately, it sounds like counterintuitive, but it's clearly one thing that has had to be honed in every athlete.
I love that you say this, because it makes it sound cool, you know, because now, but I could be me operating on a very high capacity for a while.
Yeah.
It's like I'm a super athlete, and I, of course, I will need rest and recovery. Like, that's a framing that is just narratively so much more nice than I am failing at life, which is exactly what it might feel like otherwise. Yeah.
That's why I call it mental fitness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bodily fitness as well as mental fitness needs to be catered to. And there are many factors that lead to that. I mean, of course, you're not going to always have one type of training.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good for the joints in the physical domain.
There's, of course, the difficulty here is that in a gig economy, we don't always control when the next project starts. And right now, there is just such demand for everyone in this industry that very many people go from Sunday to Monday, from one project to the next, with no recovery time at all. And sometimes they don't have the financial resources to make other choices.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's always also that fear, you know, because if that's when it starts, that's when I have to be there, you know, or maybe I wait 2 months. But I guess, of course, in this economy, maybe I don't wait 2 months. Maybe I would wait 3 weeks, and then the next project that would be available to me starts. And then actually that's a pretty good time to do like my rest and recovery discipline.
Right. Yeah. Look at the Facebook's likes or the Instagram. Yeah. People are really fallen for that. And yes, I also understand clearly that when you don't have a physical safe environment, then that gets even worse. And this is why also the Me Too movement came up, because that behavior of, well, okay, well, I'm not going to hire you if you don't, whatever, mm-hmm. do this or be like that.
And work 16 hours. But I mean, even more if there's a threat of physical violence, of course,
right,
yes.
Right, right. And so that's, I would say, is more the systemic issue.
Mm-hmm.
And When in Locarno, I was basically speaking with one of a very famous producer, and she was saying that one of the things that people need to have on their set and on her sets, it's always that people have a possibility to basically address when things are not okay.
Yeah.
And I like that idea. And so maybe have an independent place that you don't feel any retributions and you don't feel threatened if you go there to say, well, things in this way are not okay. Obviously, the person in charge of that needs to be reliable as well as trustworthy. And that, of course, trust is one of the most delicate qualities, and it's a mental quality, it's not a physical quality.
And power is clustering very much on the top of these artistic and functional hierarchies, on, for instance, a film set and in this industry. And then if a person on the at the top is a problem, it becomes very, very difficult to do anything about. Yes.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we don't have to. And I think this is where it also, this is this other concern, or I guess maybe it's a point of hope, really, is that this is a business issue. It's mission critical, especially now when it's impossible to get crews and talent and we're competing for all the best projects. And there really is a market where the best project can go anywhere. You know, having a good reputation as a work environment that doesn't break people is actually a business asset. It's a competitive
Absolutely.
Asset. And in addition, you can't afford people breaking in the middle of a production, because replacing someone halfway through is very, very expensive in time and money. So even if you happen to be a kind of person who might be listening to this, who is saying that this is some soft, you know, this is personal stuff and people should just, you know, shall be responsible for sleeping more themselves or something like that, this is also a business issue. And I don't think we can separate them.
I mean, if you talk about sustainability, you touch obviously many levels. I mean, there's the environmental sustainability, but also individual and also production sustainability. And
yes.
It's clear, why would you want to work with somebody who is basically a bully?
Mm.
You better work with somebody that is not a bully. So if your reputation is built around being a person that is really great to work for, well, you're not going to have issues around that, because everybody will come to you. Now, that's a skill that even the producer or the person that is in charge of anything, of the set or of the team or the catering, you will want not to just be basically performing well, but be disliked. But you want to be performing and be liked for.
Yes. And as you were saying at the beginning, this actually, in an environment which is without fear or with very little fear, people will be operating better. People will be better at their jobs. They will be solving problems more efficiently. They will be predicting problems and preventing them before they happen. So on every level, you're also going to get a more functioning practically, but also a more creative work environment. And then again, that becomes a positive cycle of trust. Solving difficult problems together successfully
Correct.
Builds trust
Correct.
Very efficiently in people as well.
Yeah, and that's I think where really mental fitness, and I just use that because it doesn't have that kind of like pathology side. I mean, all
yeah.
of us want to be healthy, very few ones, and of course we start having habitual behaviors that are not healthy. And I think everybody of us knows when things are not so okay, but we kind of like just, oh, okay, for the moment we can neglect it. On the mental level, you cannot, because
yeah.
it will continue to creep up on you. And so mental fitness is, how do I respond? What do we want to be? Do we want just to be rich and famous? Or do we want to be a person that is helping others? And so it's clearly that the status question here becomes an issue.
Yeah. And I do think in the film industry in Europe, a lot of people, most of us, I think, in some way we work because we find it meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an asset as well. That's a gift that we have that can help us make
right.
positive change, I guess. We're running out of time. I could talk about this all day. I mean, this is fascinating.
Likewise, I do talk
but
about it all
I guess, yes, exactly. I guess there's time for like a final recommendation. What would you say would be the most important change that we should start with? What could that be?
For me, it's really becoming aware of what are the factors that lead to flourishing, not just surviving. And of course, flourishing is when we're creative, when we're joyful, when we are loving, caring, and I mentioned already creativity, but also when we are basically thriving.
Yeah.
Now, become aware of that and what are the obstacles. And then work with the obstacles, not by suppressing them, but by overcoming them. And having tools that allow you to do that internal process.
That's fantastic. I think many of us believe in our hearts that we're working in the best industry in the world from this perspective, which is also, I suppose, why we stick around, even though in practice we're very often not working in the best industry in the world at all. So I think we can see that yearning, like the potential of flourishing. And that's, I guess, what we should move towards. Thank you so much for taking this time to talk to us today, Diego.
It's Thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity. And I look forward to hearing more and maybe even support.
Thank you.
Bye.
After this fascinating talk, we are now ready to move on to our next guest. Laurence Lascari is a film producer and was one of the participants at Locarno's Step In think tank, looking for paths towards less dangerous, less toxic, more inclusive and healthier cultures in our film industry work environments. She is also co-president of France's Le Collectif 50-50 and has received national honors for her services to the film industry. Laurence, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Johanna.
So in this conversation with Diego Hangartner that I had just now, we discussed the Looking Glass study from the UK Film, TV and Cinema Industries, which was released in early 2020. And it had some shocking numbers about how terribly the pressures of the British film industry are affecting the well-being of the people in it. Would you say that we can assume that the structures and the consequences are similar or all across Europe?
Definitely. I can speak about France. And what I can say is that until recently, the prevention of psychosocial risks and the improvement of well-being were not really a topic in our industry. We were globally in the belief that cinema and TV were different worlds. And we believed also that we were lucky enough to do jobs that we were passionate about. So there were professionals that had the reputation of being bullies, but most of the time there were no prosecution or the victims were told to hang on. And also there were a threat to lose their jobs and the pressure was more on the victims than the abusers, because that's the question of the distribution of the power. So those who were in power basically have all rights, because a whole economic system was depending on them.
It's also horrible because when the scale of what is accepted or at least not punished goes all the way to actual criminal behavior, then of course there are other, you know, like we are exhausted or and there's other problems that are serious problems, but they are relatively so much smaller if you're thinking, well, at least I'm not getting sexually harassed right now, so I suppose I should be grateful. And then that creates a very skewed image of what is a normal work environment.
Yes, and the normal back then was and still is, unfortunately, most of the time, is that the best interest of the film should necessarily prevail and over any other consideration.
And that's artistic interests then, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes us all kind of complicit of the unhealthy working environment.
In the European cultural tradition, we have a really strong internalized norm that connects artistic practice with suffering. We have this idea that poverty and discomfort and sacrifice will maybe make you a better artist. And I mean, I guess it's probably true that having powerful, difficult experiences in your life might at least give you stories to tell, and having to fight for your vision probably might make it clearer or something like that. It's also becoming scientifically very obvious now that living in fear does not actually make you a better artist. Like, it doesn't make you more creative or more productive or anything like that. So I don't know, how would you say that these narratives that you know, we're a storytelling industry, but we also tell ourselves stories about ourselves. And how present are they, would you say, in our cultures?
It's true that we have the storytelling of the damn artist who suffers for his art, and that's what makes great art. But I think we are in 2021 and we can no longer nurture this kind of belief, because we have data, we have studies that show that the better your crew and your team feel at work, and the best energy they can put in work. So hopefully, but this is something that we must advocate for. We need to create a better work environment for our teams.
This study from the UK was based on pre-pandemic numbers, and I know that they're going to make it again. And again, they interviewed over, or they surveyed over 9,000 people, so it's very reliable. But until we get the next version of that, based just on your experience, how would you say the situation has changed during the pandemic?
I think that the first thing that has changed is the working from home situation, because it has become the new normal now, and it has impacted all company, because beforehand, working from home was mostly a topic for large companies and organization. And now it concerns us all. Even the tiny festival, non-profit, or even companies such as mine. We are seven in my company, and it has impacted us a big time. On a very personal level, I had a baby 1 year ago. And before having my first child, I was in the belief that I had to choose between being a mother or being a hardworking, a professional, and successful entrepreneur. And I realized that the working from home gave me a great sense of freedom. And I felt that I was dedicated to both my son and my company. At the same time, it helped me to understand the importance of the human well-being in the office. Because I was so focusing on, I was so focused on my son, trying to put all the financing together to produce the next film, and also changing the world with a collective 50-50, that I was not really concerned. I was not concerned enough about the well-being of my team. And one of them complained. One member of my team complained that she felt that I was not paying attention to her. So that's how I realized that it's important also to ensure that the team understand the vision, they know where we are going, and also to pay attention to the sign of suffering, because for some of them it was a source of a lot of anxiety. Not to know what the future was going to be, even for the company. We evolve in a very stressful environment. And as a small production company, a small independent production company, you are basically at danger all the time, because you don't know if you are going to be able to raise the money for your next project, if you are going to be able to pay the salary. And during the pandemic, which is not over, but hopefully we were able to go back to shooting and producing. There was so much uncertainty that, and we are not built the same. So I was trying to cope with that. And sometimes I also felt very anxious and even depressed in a way. And it affected, and I didn't realize how much it had affected some of my crew member.
And that there is the culture of, are we allowed to talk about how stressed we are? Does that make us more stressed, or does it make it safer? There are questions like these that we haven't historically, we haven't historically done that. So we're going to have to learn the skills of how to do that as well, I think, on the team level.
Yes, and you can do it in a very simple way. For instance, during the beginning of a meeting, we do weekly meeting. Mm-hmm. And me, I'm the type to be focused on work and work. But I have learned also to ask the team, how are you today? How do you feel? But meaning it, so that everyone feels that it's also okay to have feelings, to share them, and to feel like safe to, yes, to share any kind of feeling.
In our previous conversation, Diego made like a core observation. I'm going to try and summarize it and see what you say. He said that a lot of in this sector, a lot of our work, it places us under different kinds of pressures. Physical pressures, like lack of sleep would be one, or physical fear reactions to the uncertainty. Financial pressures, such as the concern that we might not be hired again if we set the boundary or if we fail at a task or something like that. And also social pressures. So we have these cultural norms that we will all work a million hours or that you have to accept a certain level of bullying or harassment to be able to continue in the industry. And inside the human brain, apparently all of these pressures contribute to basically shutting down functions. So when we are under these pressures, it makes us less creative, less logical, and less able to solve problems. And what strikes me about all this is that this is not an individual health problem at all. It becomes a collective problem. It becomes a business problem. It becomes an artistic problem for every production and also across the industry. And also, I mean, I suppose it has to make our industry less attractive to young talent. It makes our productions more expensive. It makes us artistically weaker. And I'm feeling a little bit overwhelmed at like, where do we begin? So maybe we start here. How aware would you say right now that the industry is of all of these mechanisms? Like what's our starting point today?
We are so behind than the, I'm sorry, but this is true. Like, yeah, I've been to many panels, discussions, and this issue in particular is very new. I don't know what is your experience, but to me, it's very new. And in the normal world, I would say like they've been discussing for that like for decades. So we are really behind. And it's true. You're right when about the what you just said about being pragmatic and understand that we need to, because they don't, this is not an industry that pays a lot of money, and it's becoming more and more difficult. So if you don't have the money, you don't have the well-being, the passion won't last, because mm-hmm. because at some point the talents will leave to do a 9-to-5 job and that pays more money and so forth. And I'm not talking about the visible jobs, artistic jobs, production jobs that put you on the light. I'm talking about all the rest. The people that works in office or the crew members that are invisible. So we need to ensure that the industry is able to keep its talent.
And actually maybe even some of the visible jobs, because I'm thinking we've had this mystery for some time, at least in the Nordics, half of the students, half of the, you know, screenwriters, half of the directors that come out of the schools are women. But by the second film, a lot of the women have disappeared. And we were all going around saying, oh, it's a mystery. What happens to them? I think after Me Too, we know what happens. Like, it's just, it costs too much. It's hard enough to have an artistic career at all if you're facing a lot of additional pressures. And of course, that we know that the intersectional mechanisms here are ruthless. Anything that makes it harder makes it sort of impossible. And then if you're talented and driven, why would you take that? Why would you stay? You know, and maybe some people feel they have to. But if you have any other thing that you can imagine doing, I think I understand why people leave. And that's not how I want this to work at all, you know.
And that's why with the collective 50-50, we advocate for a more gender-balanced industry, not only in the position of directors or scriptwriter, but also to any other jobs, because we believe and we know that having a more gender-balanced crew is also going to fight the toxic masculinity that's been around for years. And how we do that is that we manage to launch a parity bonus So the French film agency is going to give extra money to the producers that are able to prove that in the key position, for instance, DOP, sound engineer, producer, line producer, and so forth, costume designer, and so forth, we are able to show that there is a gender-balanced team. So it means that a film can be directed by a man, but also be eligible to the parity bonus. So this is an example. We also produced with the European Commission a campaign in order to show the jobs that are mainly masculine, in order to present a woman having a male masculine jobs. And it's in order to show role models and it's a way to foster diversity and inclusion in the film industry by portraying those women. So this is another example. We're working on a white book in order to prevent and to know how to manage harassment, sexual violence during production. And to achieve that, we've been working with union representatives, other organizations, public authorities. And now the French Film Agency also had made mandatory for all producers to attend a training on how to address harassment and sexual or gender-based violence.
All of these initiatives are fantastic. And I of course, I mean, I think it's particularly amazing, but also heartbreaking that that's needed, that kind of training. Because in a lot of European countries, and this might not be as, you know, obvious everywhere in the world, but we do have a lot of just like workplace safety laws that should also already cover, you know, all of these practices have been addressed on a regulatory level literally decades ago, but we just have been unable to live up to these goals. It becomes, I don't know.
Yes, yeah. But maybe it's not as in a regular company, you see the same people throughout the year and you can build policies and so forth. During production, you work with 99% of freelancers or actors so there is difficult to build a unique policy. So we need the public authorities, we need to training, and we are also working on a larger training, not only for the executive producers, but for every member of the crew. We need to train the people on set who is going to be in charge to prevent harassment. So there's a lot of work to be done. But
you're right, of course. I wasn't thinking, I forgot that, oh yeah, like a lot of other industries are structured differently. And you're right. But I think also this is interesting because the next step, in a way, this is about policing like actual crimes in a way and preventing them. But then, yeah, prevention becomes about what kinds of company cultures or what kinds of local work cultures do we actually want. So that's about positive design in a way. But here an individual producer, I imagine like you probably have actually a lot of power over how do we work on this shoot. Do you feel empowered to create a different workplace culture for yourself, or do you see resistance from your crews?
Yes, and as the co-chair of Collective 50-50, I am at the best place to learn and then to put in practice. And this is what I did with a film that is currently shooting and that I executively produced. For instance, I asked to the crew for a volunteer to be the referent, the anti-harassment referent, so that if there is a problem, all the crew know who to talk to. And I had to set up a meeting, and it was kind of stressful in a way. It was the first day of shooting during the lunch break, and they were all minding their business, and you feel that you are the annoying person at the moment.
Yes.
But I took this opportunity to address all of them and to express my strong commitment to fight harassment, and that no form of abusing or bullying is going to be tolerated. I had to try to put some humor in my speech so that I don't know, it became something normal. And the thing that was positive about it is that I had the total support of the director, because the real boss on the set is the director. So it was important to me that he supported me. And also in the contract, for every contract that was signed, I mean hiring a contract, there was this clause that stating precisely that no form or harassment of any kind were to be tolerated during the shooting. So if every single producers put those policies individually in place, I think that is going to help big time.
I'm thinking two things that are kind of the opposites now. One is that it's kind of cool. I mean, one upside of having a very kind of hierarchical industry is that the people with the most power, if we know that a toxic or bullying director can be an enormous problem, then it's also the opposite is true. A person who is constructive and who is invested in creating a positive culture also has the power to create a positive culture. The producer can do it on the level of the project, but you are right also, and that's the opposite thing, unfortunately, that on set, it often is the director who formally and informally, but certainly informally, I feel, has the sort of highest decision-making and culture-making power. So I then, I guess, in the European context, we have to ask ourselves, do you feel that auteur cinema or auteur-focused, auteur-adjacent cinema, you know, is particularly sensitive to these problems?
Yes, because there is a greater sense of danger, so that people can be asked to hang on because, for instance, maybe you don't have put all the money in place, or maybe artistically it's very challenging. And so that there is, I think that there is more pressure because there it's another kind of pressure than just doing your job at the best level. There are other things that come in the conversation, and yes, I think that, and it's also like more borderline because it won't be by the book on the bigger production. the freelancer are going to be less tolerant because they know that there is money, so they won't hesitate to be more challenging, more demanding for the safety, and so forth. But of course, it doesn't mean that they are going to be protected and that nothing is going to happen to them. But I have the feeling that, yes, it can be more challenging.
I see what you're... Yeah, so there's a lot of things that are happening. One is, of course, that if it's more experimental in method or in expression, there's a certain level of uncertainty that comes with that. If it's a smaller budget, there's a loyalty to the project that comes with that, which is so strong with us. And also, in a way, I suppose that this idea that you have you're in the service of an individual's artistic vision to a much higher degree also. So your job becomes, in a way, to keep them happy. They have to be able to work, and that's more important than whether I'm able to work, I guess.
Yes, and there is something more about that comes to, I don't know, affection, that is also at stake. And you don't want to disappoint your filmmaker. But in comparison, if you are doing a job because that's your, with less passion and being less personally involved in that project, then you won't be less tolerant.
So it's once again, and I think I feel like we were touching on this a little bit with Diego as well, and now it's even clearer to me that the very thing that makes this industry so appealing, you know, that we are allowed to work in meaningful context with a lot of passion, that's also the exact same mechanism that allows us to work under terrible conditions because we are ready to sacrifice so many things, not just to be able to get the next job, which is a structural challenge that's really important, but also just to be able to, because we're in service of the artistic project as well. Yeah, I think you mentioned early on that the supremacy of the artistic vision can get in the way of making changes in these things. Do you want to talk a little bit about what kinds of challenges that can be on a practical level?
Yes, sure. For instance, we are having the conversation in France right now about the intimacy coordinator.
Yes.
There are some people, filmmakers or so forth, that they say that the director as the the almighty person on the set should know. He knows or she knows. And an intimacy coordinator would affect his or her freedom of creation. But it's funny because there is no discussion. For instance, when there is a stunt coordinator, for instance, on set,
yeah,
there is no discussion.
Right.
So why would that be for the intimacy of those?
Also, literally, we're working in an art form where limitations are the mother of creation. I mean, and there are, when it comes even to a sex scene, it, throughout the history of cinema, we have been working with limitations about what you are allowed to show and how, like, the... You never in the history of cinema outside of pornography have you have the freedom to show physically intimate interactions without any limitations at all. Artistically or in matters of taste or in matters of morals or in matters of law, there have always been limitations. Oh. And now it's a problem when it's helping the actors.
Mm.
I find it very difficult to sympathize with this perspective. But I see what you mean. I see how that could be an issue. So then that actually goes kind of back to the idea that, so there's an ideological shift in a way, if we're saying, no, actors also are a co-creator of this film, and their ability and every crew member's ability somehow to operate on a high level of artistic competence and integrity, it will make the outcome better.
Yeah.
And that is slightly in some ways in conflict with the idea that the director is a god who will always know and whose idea will always be better than anybody else's idea or limitation. I don't know. You're a producer. I think it must be in your, it has to be your job to say no to directors quite often.
Yes, kind of. Or sometimes say yes in order to obtain the no.
Yes. How do we change this? I mean, do we wait for these people to age out of the industry or is it possible to show somehow? I mean, I guess maybe they just need a good experience of working with an intimacy coordinator so they can understand that it unlocks something positive. It's not a limitation.
I think it's a bit of both. Of course, it's a generation issue, and the younger filmmakers are more open to having that discussion. But at the same time, you have many established filmmakers, for instance, Jacques Audiard, who were able to also ask for help for those scenes. So I think it's evolving, and... as the collective 50-50, our job is also to give give tools to create them if they don't exist, so that we are better at doing our jobs. Because it's not only about filming, directing, lighting. It's also how we create is also important.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And perhaps that's where we should end. I feel like it's very thought-provoking to me that Diego kind of landed on this idea that we have to self-monitor, we have to become aware of what are the patterns that I do, where I sabotage my own performance and my own creativity and my own joy. Like, what would it take for me to thrive? And I think maybe this is also pointing at a similar thing in the industry, which is we have to look at how... what kinds of stories and ideals about the artistic process are sabotaging us from working, from thriving artistically. And that's also as important in a way. And the outcome, of course, would be that films would be best. If we say that you're allowed to sort of send in some thought into the world, where would you begin changing? What's the most important thing for all of us to do next?
It might sound corny, but what I've learned is that the systemic change starts within ourselves. And this is what I am trying to experience every day, because as an entrepreneur, I'm fully dedicated to my company. I work day, night, during the weekends. And I try to remind myself that this is my choice And I have to ensure, for instance, when I'm thinking of something and I feel like sending a text, I have to stop for a second and ask myself, do I really need to send this text on a Saturday? And if I do, for instance, I prefer a mail so that my team can open it whenever they want. It's less intrusive than a text. I do make sure to mention that I don't expect an answer until the next day, the next Monday or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's when you hire someone, it's important to feel that the person is highly motivated, but you have to make sure that you don't ask for the impossible.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I think, yeah, everybody has power over some little bit of the industry. And you're right, that's where we're going to begin. This was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joanna. I was very happy to be with you.
That's where we will end the podcast today. Thanks again to our guests, to the Goethe Institute for supporting this podcast from the European film market, and to Locarno Pro for collaborating on the content of this episode. If this episode made you think of something special, please do drop us a line in any of our channels. If you're not a subscriber already, do hit subscribe on your podcast provider or look us up at www.efmberlinale.de. That's www.efm-berlinale.de. And if you really like us, rate us. That helps others find the show.